Good evening, John. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You flew on the Space Lab 2 to study the Sun. What exactly was that mission aimed at?
Well, we had quite a few astronomy experiments on this mission. Four of them were solar telescopes mounted on a special pointing control that could point very precisely at the Sun. And these four experiments looked at the Sun in ultraviolet light, which is light so violet that you can't see it with the naked eye. And also one of the experiments was designed to measure the detailed magnetic fields on the Sun. And the three experiments that looked at ultraviolet light had different jobs. One of them was looking at the total ultraviolet light coming from the whole surface of the Sun. And that's important to know because, as you know, it's the ultraviolet light that hits the top of the Earth's atmosphere and makes the ozone out of the oxygen. So knowing how much ultraviolet light is hitting the top is very important.
We can't study ultraviolet light from the ground, can we?
No, it's blocked by the Earth's atmosphere when you get to about 3,000 angstroms and lower.
And your experiment on that particular mission, you had a particular one yourself, didn't you?
Yes, two of those experiments on that mission were built by my group at the Naval Research Laboratory, which is a research laboratory in Washington, D.C. And one of them was designed to measure the total output of the Sun, as I mentioned, and the other was designed to look at the very detailed small features on the Sun in ultraviolet light to try to understand the mystery of why the Sun's outer atmosphere is actually hotter than the atmosphere at the surface of the Sun.
That's a problem that's been largely resolved in just the last few months, hasn't it?
We think we understand it a lot more now, that it is due to magnetic fields breaking up on the surface of the Sun and releasing a lot of energy, which then suddenly heats the atmosphere above the surface of the Sun.
Have you been following the SOHO mission that's been studying the Sun, and have you, I think it's TRACE, isn't it, that's recently been put up to study the Sun?
I have certainly been following the SOHO mission, which is a combination European and American satellite. In fact, one of those experiments on that mission, I was the principal investigator when we proposed it to NASA, and shortly after that, I actually left the Naval Research Laboratory and started to work for NASA. So I was, of course, very interested to see it selected and actually perform its mission.
I suppose you've got your fingers crossed at the moment that they get it recovered properly.
I sure do. I understand that there is still some hope, and we certainly do have our fingers crossed.
The Naval Research Laboratory, of course, has a history of solar studies going right back to some of its earliest satellites. Could you perhaps run us through some of that quite wonderful story, actually?
Actually, the very first solar experiments that were done at the Naval Research Laboratory used V-2 rockets, which were brought from Germany to the United States after the war. There were about 50 of those rockets carried over and sent to White Sands in New Mexico to study how they worked, and we got the opportunity. We suggested right away that we should put some experiments on them so that we could look at the Sun when the rocket went above the Earth's atmosphere. So that was the beginning of the space solar program.
The SOLRAD satellites were before your time. They had a sort of a mixed military-scientific application, didn't they?
Yeah, again, the idea of the SOLRAD satellites was to try to understand how the radiation from the Sun is varying with time, because when very violent events occur on the Sun, they affect the Earth's atmosphere, and then they also affect communications on the Earth. And obviously communications is very important to the military, so we have always been searching for a way to predict how the Sun is going to perform, just like we try to predict the weather here on Earth, so you would know in advance if you were going to have communications trouble.
That, of course, was before your time with NRL, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I didn't come to NRL until 1966, and began working then on, first experiment was on an orbiting solar observatory, which was a series of solar satellites, of 8 of them flown by NASA over a period of time, and we had experiments on quite a few of them.
What were the primary findings of those series of satellites, built by Ball Aerospace, I believe, and flown for NASA with your instruments?
Well, that was the beginning of our understanding of the all of the different ions that were actually causing the emission in the ultraviolet. We had really not studied the ultraviolet part of the sun before, till we got above the Earth's atmosphere, and we certainly did not appreciate the very high temperature material that was up there. We would see emission there caused by states of materials like iron, where almost all of the electrons had been stripped from the iron, so that you would have like iron 25, which means iron with 24 of its electrons gone because it's so hot. And that's when we first started understanding and seeing these effects in solar flares.
Of course, the OSO satellites, or orbiting solar observatories, had fairly low resolution. You must have really been wanting to really get a good detailed look at the sun. So what was your next step?
Well, you know, when we had the opportunity to build a larger instrument, which means it could be physically much longer, and that permitted us then to make an instrument with better resolution, we had a chance to fly them on the Skylab space station. There was a cluster, in fact, of 5 or 6 solar telescopes. 2 of those were built by the Naval Research Laboratory. And at that time, which was in the early 1970s, the very best detector to use with the very highest resolution was photographic film. So this was a perfect opportunity because we were going to go to and from Skylab and we could bring the film back. So we developed 2 large instruments with photographic film at the focal plane and took thousands of pictures of the sun. And in fact, you mentioned you have one of these at home. And this material has been analyzed for years and is still, we still are publishing papers actually from the Skylab results.
Was that the, you know, you mentioned you took it on photographic film. Was that why you had to do a spacewalk? I mean, not you personally, but the astronauts had to do a spacewalk out to the end of that truss-like structure with a big dish at the end.
Exactly. We had large cameras, which were about the size of a small suitcase, and the astronauts would have to go out and change these cameras about once a month.
Had they not decided to only use 3 missions to that space station, would it have been possible to continue and get extra data from the sun, or would he have just simply been repeating and the data, you know, not worthwhile doing?
No, there certainly was more data to collect because we really were limited in how many pictures we could take because of the amount of film on board. So we didn't take pictures as often as we would have liked to if we had an unlimited supply. So there are many events that we were not able to study on the sun because of that limit.
But were you disappointed that Skylab didn't continue?
Well, it had served out its life. We were actually felt very fortunate that we had the opportunity to put our experiments on Skylab in the first place. Our first vision of a telescope using film in the Apollo program was much less grandiose than we ended up with Skylab, so we were actually extremely pleased.
And after Skylab, which was, of course, in 1972-73, you then had a long wait for further missions, didn't you?
Yes, there was a time period that there were only a couple of solar satellites. The Solar Maximum mission flew in the late 70s, I think. Yes, that's right. We at NRL did not have an experiment on that particular satellite, But we, at that time, started working on an entirely new kind of ultraviolet spectrograph, also using film. It was based on a new optical system that we invented at NRL. And we tested this system several times on a sounding rocket, and it got some very excellent results, even though the time period, of course, it was only 5 minutes above the Earth's atmosphere. And we worked on refining this telescope and spectrograph over the next few years, and that's what prepared us for our next opportunity to fly it on Spacelab.
And that's when you got the chance to actually fly in space yourself.
That's correct. At that time, a decision was made that we would fly two solar physicists on this mission because the solar experiments required a lot of work on board looking at TV images that were coming out of the telescopes, and those images were only available on board because we didn't really have a system at that time to send down so much television data from the shuttle. So we on board then would look at the images, make the decisions about where to make the observations, and then fire up the experiments to run a sequence of observations.
And that proved the value of having a scientist in space.
It certainly did. For that case, it was exactly the right use of a scientist in space. This was a situation which required somebody present up there in order to get the result you wanted.
To what extent were you able to interact with the other solar scientists on the ground?
Well, that was a very important part of it, because it certainly was not all done just by the two of us up there. We had a very strong team of scientists with... Again, there were four experiments on this mission, and each experimenter had a team, and we were in constant communication with them on the ground. In fact, every time around the Earth, every 90 minutes, we would have, just before the sun would come up for us on orbit, we would have a 5-minute solar meeting with them to decide exactly what we were going to observe over the next 1 hour until the sun set again.
And what were the advantages of using Spacelab as against using the unmanned orbiting satellites?
Well, there were several things we were able to do here that we could not do on the free-flying satellites. One is we could actually fly much larger instruments because we had so much more launch capability in the shuttle. One of my two experiments weighed over 500 kilograms, which is almost 10 times as heavy as an experiment that you could put on an orbiting solar observatory or something like that. We had a lot more power. We had 3 kilowatts of power to use. They didn't limit the design of our experiments. These parameters did not limit it. We had a lot more data to the ground. Even though we couldn't get down all the images, we could get down some because we had a 50 megabit per second downlink system, and which was just unheard of at that time in 1985 from a satellite.
Had any of the covers over the instruments not come off, or anything gone wrong with some of the instruments? Would it have been possible to hop outside, do a spacewalk, EVA, and attend to the problem?
Yes, we had contingency procedures for certain EVA things we could do to help the experiments if we needed them, and fortunately we didn't have to exercise those.
Needless to say, that would not have been possible on an unmanned craft. Now, they've flown a number of other astronomical flights on the shuttle, and I believe you did Capcom on the Astro mission. What was Astro about?
Well, this was a mission, actually. It flew twice. There was Astro 1 and 2, and this was contained four astronomical telescopes. So that we were looking at stars and galaxies. It was also mounted on the special precision pointing control, the same control we used on my flight that was built by the European Space Agency. And again, they were ultraviolet telescopes, taking advantage of the fact that they needed to go above the Earth's atmosphere. And one of them was a fairly large diameter telescope, 1 meter in diameter. It was the largest telescope we had put up at that time. And it involved, again, a lot of images, so onboard crew decisions, and a team on the ground helping them along.
You mentioned that the European IPS, the instrument pointing system, which pointed the thing at the at the sun. It must be incredibly difficult to keep a telescope aboard a space shuttle, which is travelling at 28,000 kilometres an hour or so, pointed at the target accurately.
Yes, it is quite a feat to do that, and it this system worked extremely well. It was based on using star trackers to track on certain stars to keep it in a position, and it also used accelerometers and gyroscopes to sense how it was moving, and all this data was then fed into a computer to keep it still.
I remember many years ago, in fact the argument still persists to some extent today, the argument between manned and unmanned craft, and the argument was that people moving around aboard the space vehicle, the shuttle, would cause small vibrations and disturbances. Does that in fact affect your observations?
Well, definitely. The presence of the people moving do cause vibrations. But we have been able to design systems which overcome those vibrations. So we're able to balance the ill effects of a person moving with the advantages of having the person there to make decisions.
After that, I believe you have moved away from that particular program, and you're now working on the space station.
Correct. Shortly after I flew, I was asked to come to NASA headquarters as the chief scientist for the space station program, and I worked there for about 5 years.
Well, perhaps going back to your time aboard the shuttle, perhaps what were some of the most memorable things you did there?
Well, I think certainly the first most memorable experience is that first time that you look out the window and look down on the surface of the Earth. I must admit it was a total surprise to me. Sure, I had read about it and had seen pictures, but I had no idea it would be so overwhelming as when I looked down.
And you'd support the idea of space tourism and so on that allows other people to have the same experience?
Definitely. In fact, there's more and more interest in that, and I think that's extremely important to develop even more efficient ways to get into space, is to get this commercial interest to try to come up with ways of taking people there for their own look.
Any chance of you flying again on the shuttle? And if not, would you be in the queue to buy the ticket on the space tourist journey?
Well, right now, I don't think I'll be flying again on the shuttle. I'm a bureaucrat now. I'm working on the plans for other scientists. And besides, I think I'm really too young. I have to wait until I'm as old as John Glenn to fly again.
Well, thank you, John, for joining us tonight on the Space Show.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for inviting me.